Welcome to the Middle Tech Spotlight Series, where we highlight entrepreneurs, investors, and ecosystem supporters that are building our startup ecosystem. We've been talking to founders consistently over the last 4 years, and we want to use this series to keep tabs on the companies being built here. Today, we're talking with Randall Stevens of Avail, being built here in Lexington, Kentucky. Avail is a software-as-a-service platform that helps architects, engineers, and construction industry professionals to more efficiently manage and leverage their building information modeling content, BIM for short. Think of that as like the digital files that represent all of the items that are used in a building. Before diving in, we'd like to highlight the sponsors that make all of this possible. Before highlighting our sponsors, we'd just like to state that the views and content shared on this platform do not necessarily reflect those of our show sponsors. Middle Tech is presented by KY Innovation, the Kentucky Cabinet for Economic Development's Office of Entrepreneurship. KY Innovation exists to support and develop Kentucky's startup ecosystem, and we are proud to be supported by an organization whose mission aligns so closely with ours. If you're a founder building in Kentucky, you need to check out the resources that KY Innovation has to offer. You can find more information by clicking the link in our show notes or going to kyinnovation.com.
All right, looking forward to catching up with Randall Stevens, somebody that I've had the joy to learn from and work with at Avail. So we're going to catch up on all things Avail and ask some questions just about general entrepreneurship as well. So thanks for joining.
Thanks. Yeah. Good to see you guys.
Looking forward to diving in. So when we last spoke, it was several years ago. It might have been before COVID. So things have changed drastically for the business. When we last spoke, it was early stages. You had the company started for probably 3 or 4 years at that point.
2017 was the start.
Yep. So 2 years, 3 years at that point.
Product entered the market in 2017. We, a couple of years before that, actually developing the product. But COVID, you know, when you were involved was right, you know, around the time COVID stuff hit. That was a big, you know, like a lot of companies, you either were, that caused you to take off or it caused you to put the brakes on. And for us, it was a lot of everybody kind of waiting and standing still. So we went for about 18 months of seeing not only our customers begin to lay off people in that industry, which affected, you know, their use of Avail, number of people that were using it. So we saw kind of a decline really happened over about the first 6 months of COVID.
We'll go into your customers and why COVID affected them real quick. Well,
let's start just high level what the business does first. We'll get into that.
Yeah. So Avail we refer to it as a content management platform. So typically large architecture, engineering, construction firms. Most of our customers have been very large architecture firms. We've now have 3 of the 4 largest architecture firms in the world are customers. We help them manage what I call loose content. So there's just a lot of information. It ends up in files of all different types, a lot of technical information, data typically was stored in a file system somewhere in folders. And as organizations' scale grows and the amount of content information they have grows, that becomes kind of an untenable way to get to that information. So Avail solves that problem by kind of putting think of it like a vertical search engine inside of a firm in front of all that info. So no more rooting around in Windows file folders. You basically go to Avail to begin your journey, search, finding this information. So we help our customers do that. We've been heavy in the architecture, beginning to get more larger engineering firms using the product, but we've kind of been on that journey through the AEC industry, architecture, engineering, construction. And started with the architecture market, which is what I had most experience in and knew a lot of people in the industry. And, you know, it's a nice place to start because that's usually where the projects actually start. So we're in kind of involved in those projects from a very early stage inside those firms and beginning to kind of take the data journey across those projects using Avail as those projects kind of move on through their different phases. I mean, the one thing people may not realize about, it's not atypical for a project to last 5 years plus from the time that that project starts to the time it actually gets designed and built and is on the ground is on average probably 5 years.
And one of the things that always amazed me was how many files could one of those projects have?
Oh, I mean, depends on the scale of project. Could have tens of thousands, could have millions of things in a building.
Because every doorknob could be a file.
Everything. Typically not that many files sitting out there, but it's not atypical for one of my favorite tricks to do is, or things I do when I go out visiting customers all around the world is I'll have them go to on their network where the last project that they finished, like it's usually a high level folder on the network where a lot of that data was stored. Have them right click and do a properties, you know, in the file system, and it'll tell you how many folders there are and how many files are in those folders. Low end, few hundred or a few low thousand folders with 5-10,000 files in it. I've seen some that are 5,000 folders and subfolders with 120,000 files in it, right? So a lot of info and data, depends on the project. So you can imagine as a project is larger and larger scale, usually more and more people working on it. That's the problem.
And then COVID hit. Why did COVID affect? What did your customers go through?
They laid off people.
Yeah.
We saw the large firms, probably 20 to 30% of the workforce got laid off. And that happened over the first 3-4 months. By summer, we saw the decline because we were, you know, we actually sit on the desk where these people are using it. So we saw the usage go whoop. And then for about another year, it was really just kind of holding steady, right? I think that was the time when everybody was just like, okay, what's going to happen next? We saw it in the data. And so for a lot of, you know, a lot of spend went on hold. The spend was being directed towards, I like to think of it as the network disruption. Everybody went home to work. So all of a sudden everybody's networks went into turmoil and they all attention and focus was on the new workflows and where is all this stuff now and how's all that work. So it took about all said and done about 18 months before we saw everybody coming. Okay, we're back to kind of the new normal. And now let's start investing again in, you know, things like what we're doing for the industry.
Yeah. And let's talk about kind of the arc of the business, you know, the journey getting to where you are now. So let's start by just talking about where the idea came from and what you thought the problem you were solving was. And, you know, if that turned out to be true, if it changed any and kind of where it's progressed into this point of its life.
Yeah. So I can trace, you know, I've been in the industry for 30 years now. I'm an architect by training, was in the industry. I have another company that was in the 3D visualization side of that business. So had been around the industry, you know, knew a lot of the companies. I can trace the roots of what became Avail back 15 years ago. Started thinking about it in a way, and then really started thinking about it in earnest ten years ago. And the other company was developing, so Avail actually was developed inside this other company called ArcVision. And then we kind of had, I called it a couple of false starts on developing it as a product inside of there. There was a couple of little early iterations that were kind of on that track. Had a couple of false starts, I think, on really developing what became Avail. In 2015, started really working on it, ultimately what became Avail, spun it out into a separate company. So it goes back, you know, lots of thinking and noodling, you know, and thinking about what the problem was. The original problem, you know, set was really that there were lots of files sitting on these in a file system, you know, Windows file folders. Like, how do you solve that in the right way? And, you know, help people get to that information in new ways. So it's evolved since then. I like to say we made a couple of key decisions technology-wise in the way we developed the product. One, we wanted to be completely content agnostic. So I like to say if it's digital, you can put it in Avail and get to it. We also decided, so we were agnostic to what kind of content you put in there. So it wasn't just an application or one specific, even though there's a couple of really dominant applications that are used and content types. We wanted to be horizontal inside of a firm. It's not unusual. It's not unusual for these firms to have 100 to 200 different applications being used in their workflow to get these jobs done. A couple of dominant platforms, but then just, you know, I've got I've had customers share with me their inventory, and it's just like, it's a lot of information. A lot of those are proprietary tools that spit out info in proprietary file formats, lots of Excel, lots of Word, lots of all the kind of typical content, right, files. So we wanted to not just be one thing. We wanted to solve that in a very broad way inside these firms. So content agnostic was one of the big design criteria. And then we also, you know, in hindsight, I think made a good decision. We actually didn't want to have to take possession of the customer's files. So if you go back to 2015, 16 timeframe when we were developing this, the cloud was becoming, you know, it was cloud this, cloud that. So I'm like, and we had some competitors in the market that were specific for certain applications, and they would take the content and put it up in their cloud location. So a little bit of this was, I wanted to position against that. But in hindsight, it's been great because from the get-go, we developed a veil to not care where the information actually is. So that's served us really well. As the cloud has exploded, there's not just a cloud, there's data everywhere, and it's living in different SaaS systems and different cloud environments. So Avail was designed from the beginning to not really care. So it's actually played really well into our hand that, hey, we're not moving your information data off of your own network or out of your own control into our system. All we're doing is gluing all this stuff together. So it's, you know, it's put us in a nice position, I think, for where, you know, I couldn't have told you that that was the problem, you know, that we would be looking at that people have today when we did it. So it's kind of nice to be, you know, it's better to be lucky than good.
Right? Yeah. And give us an idea of like a snapshot of the business. You said you have three of the top four architecture firms in the world. Give us an idea of other customer count numbers you might have, team size, anything else that you think is a metric that you want to share?
Yeah, we don't disclose a lot of specific numbers, but what I'll say is we set out to go after the top 200 firms in North America, architecture firms, which we could identify. You know, it was easy to kind of identify and go after. And, you know, we've made good headway, maybe a third of the way into those as customers. And, you know, they range from, we really kind of, what we call enterprise customers start at 50 users of the product, but some of them, we have customers that have thousands of seats. So that's kind of the range, right? I mean, the biggest firms in the world, the largest architecture firm in the world has about 7,000 employees, if that gives you. But like if you get into
Gensler.
Gensler. If you get into the architecture and engineering market, it's maybe an order of magnitude bigger. Like AECOM and some of these companies have 50, 60,000 employees, right? They're big, multinational, all over the world. So that's our hunting ground. Those are the kinds of people that we're trying to help with the product. And
then team size, how is that 14, fluctuated?
We have 14 full-time, you know, on payroll staff. We did for several years have some outsourced engineering that we were using, as many as like three other full-time engineers. We've actually, as the company has matured and grown, we've started cutting back on that and focused more on the internal team. So it's a nice size, enough to get stuff done. You know, we're still heavy, you know, more than half of that staff is engineering and working on the product. And, you know, we've got a lot still to do. So there's just a lot of product innovation and things that we're doing, continuing to do.
Well, on product innovation, just kind of a fun question here, you know, over the last 5 months, you know, generative AI has changed search and indexing and, you know, content. What are you looking at there as far as the architecture industry and where you play with that?
Glad you asked. Back in 2019, I'll kind of come about this through the back door. In 2019, we started an event we call Confluence. We were bringing people from the industry to town, really both on the tech provider side and the practitioner, you know, end user customer side. And we called it Confluence and branded it not about Avail because it wasn't about Avail. This was about just being part of the broader conversation, understanding how really that event is about what are the, I call it near-term technologies that are going to impact all of us, people developing the tech and the people using it. So we've been doing that now successfully for 4 years. We just had our first regional event. We did one in Southern California. I had 37 people in Southern California. Again, all leaders, design technology leaders in this industry. We're planning our 3-day October event, and it's going to be themed around AI and machine learning. So we're always trying to stay in the middle of that, understand what new technology is coming. What I'll say about how we'll use that, we sit on a lot of information and data, so you can imagine there's a lot to chew on from that standpoint. I think the nice thing is about this, as this technology is kind of quickly evolving, we don't have to develop it. We can apply it, right, and bring. So a lot of what I'm out doing now is finding who has that tech, who's developing those kinds of things, and can we, at the right time, bring that in on top of what we're doing on behalf of our customers and to plug those kinds of things in. So I don't have a strong urge that I have to go out and hire, you know, AI and machine learning. I think we're going to be able to plug those services in on top of what we're doing. We've got a platform. Part of what we've been doing with Avail is, now that we're 6 years in to the product, we've begun, you know, we started opening up the APIs to Avail. We've actually started developing a plugin architecture for the actual software interfaces. So as a platform, it's really well poised to start plugging stuff in and truly acting as a platform. So from that standpoint, everything that you're seeing going on, you know, there's ways to chew on documents and text. There's image side of it. You know, one of the things I'm actually interested in, where I think Avail would be interesting in this space, is, you know, everybody's talking now about being, you know, a prompt specialist, or knowing how to put information into these systems to get it back out. Through the lens that I look through, that's content. So can Avail sit in this market and say, hey, if you're putting in a prompt, that prompt just becomes content. It has to be stored, has to be retrieved. You know, if you look at, you could change a prompt and get different output. So the kinds of things that I'm thinking about are, hey, what does the future look like? Will people just not want to search for things that they've had before and just create it from scratch? Probably not. I think human nature is, hey, I did something, I know I've got it, I want to get back to it, instead of regenerating it every time. That's probably an uncomfortable place to be in the short run. But when you put a prompt in for one of these things, again, you got to save that prompt, even if that was just a big block of text. In my mind, that's like, now that's content. I need to tag it, I need to search it, I need to be able to get back to it, just so I can feed that prompt back into an engine and get, you know, result, but same result back again. So I'm not too worried that there's going to be a big need for that. The other thing that I've been, you know, that we're kind of really looking at with the Avail platform is a lot of the content, be it an image that's generated, a document that's generated, any kind of output from a piece of software, to date, I describe that as being, one, loose content. It comes off of some system without, and it's, in my mind, it's just dumb. It gets dumb again. So you could have been in a piece of software in Excel working on this, and you put some output and it gets dumb. It just sits out there. I think the future is that content coming off all of these systems, especially in an industry like the AEC industry, the applications that are producing the information should register that information with Avail. So I see the future being every piece of software, when it produces a piece of information, should register that output so that somebody can get back to it. Today, it's just dumb. It ends up on a file system. Mm. And now somebody had to go figure out which folder did that go in, so somebody else can go find it. So there's a bunch of stuff along those lines. So even these AI, when it generates the information, that information needs to come off and be registered and be able to find it. You know, think about how many people are using Midjourney.
When you say registering, you mean make it indexable
and structured data?
Yeah, good structured information. It should be findable, searchable. When it came off the system that you generated in, there was probably more info there that just got lost when the stuff got put out into
a Here's file. A cool application of this that's happening in the real estate industry is listing photos for properties. They come into the MLSs, and then there's a company called RespAI that will tag the images. And so in Neural's case, you guys are doing, you know, key value pairs, and there's tags. You know, when somebody uploads a file and it's an image, you can just pre-tag using image recognition, and then that's indexable.
You're exactly right. And take that same, you know, photos carry what's called EXIF. The standard is called EXIF data. So there's metadata that usually most of the cameras are recording onto that digital image as part of the metadata. That includes latitude, longitude, location. So now imagine that you're the architecture firm and you're designing a building and it's in Autodesk Revit. They know the latitude and longitude about where that project's actually being built. So we should be able to take the EXIF data off photos and not ask you which project this belongs to. The data's already there to match this stuff back up. But today, humans are, a lot of this is just, download these off my phone and put them on the network somewhere. And it's just like, there's all this that's going on, and all that info should be coming off these systems using, you know, the intelligence.
Does natural language search and generative AI destroy file structures, the need for it, or no?
I could argue either side of it, right? Yeah. I think time will tell. There's a lot of human nature, man, that's just, it's hard to fight what people have been doing for them to get comfortable for it. There's some of us that are like early adopters and we'll adapt. There's also a long tail of the big part of the market.
Yeah.
Man, they are reluctant and slow, and not necessarily for bad reason. I think it's like, you know, I like to think about the biological, like we're wired in certain ways, and some part of that's like change. I'm just going to wait and see who gets eaten by the lion before I jump right in there. Right. It's like, I'm not just going to be the first one out front. Hey, you know? So I think there's, we're not like dropping everything that we're doing today because we think this is all going to shift. It's like, it takes a little bit longer, right? Yeah. And people still are driving these workflows and getting their work done. Everybody's starting to experiment with how this stuff can affect, you know, what you're doing.
Well, and one interesting thing that's along these lines is you, from day one, were very meticulous and placed a high importance on watching customers and their actions in the platform, but also allowing them to watch themselves. And so as you watch your customers and as they see their own data, they can make informed decisions on whether or not generative AI even makes sense. And you'll be able to spot when it does.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's a company that just announced today that they had raised some more money, but it's all in like the, you know, when you're building a building, there's lots of law, there's lots of code. Every state's different. There's lots of rules and regulations. So at some point, you know, there's a company that's chewing on all that and starting to use AI and machine learning. It's like a virtual assistant, right? You can think about like, hey, when I'm working on this, instead of me having to comb through all this rules and regulations, can it tell me what I need to know quickly? You know, if you've played around with any of these ChatGPT or any of these, you know that there's also like what they call hallucinating, right? It's like, it'll spit back words, whether or not those are true or a fact or not. There's a bunch of vertical companies, right, that are going to fill those voids. They'll be like, we need to guarantee that this is the right information, the right data back. Because you don't want to be submitting some drawings to the city for approval and find out that, you know, your chat bot made up some, you know, rule law.
It's just you can't blame the chat bot.
Sure, the attorneys are in the same boat, right? It's like, yeah, you can get a bunch of stuff back, but you better know your case law and you better go check to make sure that that case actually exists. So that's all, you know, that'll get worked out. It's not like that won't get figured out. People will get that figured out. And then, you know, I really think that I'm an optimist about all this. I think what it's going to do is not necessarily, will it displace some kinds of work? Of course, but I think it'll really like supercharge, you know, the designer or the engineer. It's like now they can be twice as productive or 10 times as, you know, whatever. There's going to be some multiplier on their ability to be like, okay, all this menial stuff that I used to have to do, I don't really have to do it anymore, which is great. I think it if you believe in capitalism, which I'm a strong believer, I believe that as these technology shifts come, it just moves us hopefully
best further, and highest use.
Yeah. Further and further up the food chain. And, you know,
yeah, I tend to agree with the quote about AI. It's not that AI will replace this job. It's that that job will be replaced by somebody that uses AI. And I think that's very true. I've started using it in a lot of different functions of my job. And it's, you know, the more you play with it, the more you realize that it really can just, you know, 2, 3, 4x your productivity, your output, or how quickly you can do a task.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's going to vary about what your job. I saw an article, I sent it to somebody the other day. I'm like, I can tell by reading this that that they had some bot write it, because it just felt like something.
Yeah. Right?
It's like all this, like, give me the 5 things and give me the structure and all this stuff. And I read it and I'm like, all right, I could tell that this was spit out by some bot. But I've seen people that are talking about their blog. You know, it's like the whole writer's block. Like, give me something to start with. I mean, hell, architects, I never practiced, but going through architecture school, it's like you're always looking for inspiration, something that's going to like inspire you to now use my own brain. So I can see it being this kind of, it being an input to be like, okay, now you go riff on this and make it better and put it in some form. So
yeah. All right, well, back to Avail. And you know, we mentioned you guys having to adapt through COVID, that being a challenging time. What are some other challenges that you've had to overcome throughout the life of this company? You've been around for quite a while now, so I'm sure there's, you know, lots of waves that you've had to ride.
Oh, most of it's you know, like any business, finding customers is the hardest thing.
Sales,
like,
yeah.
You go. Are you developing something? Is there product market fit? Right. And here we are in our 7th year of the product on the market, and all these great customers and paying us. And you know, they're still like, have we really found it?
Yeah.
We found something, right? But you're always also trying to, you know, like, hey, where's the J curve? Where's the inflection? So there's some stuff that we're working on now that I think I've got a little bit clearer sight on where this goes next, that I think will be even a multiplier on what we're doing and solving an even bigger problem, but that probably is accurate. Like now that we've done what we've done, we can take what we've done and solve maybe an even bigger problem in the industry that will make this even more valuable to the firms using it. So I kind of feel like we're there. You know, anytime I self-funded this in the early stages as much as I could, just out of cash flow of the business that it was growing out of, and then raised a little bit of money, and we raised some, you know, kind of our first, I think we even called it a pre-seed round in 2019, which was good timing because it was right before COVID hit. We had a little bit of cash in the bank, but it was meant to scale sales. And I told you what the story of that looked like for 18 months. So it's like, oh, now you're kind of back to starting back from scratch, you know, kind of 18 months into that. We had our best first quarter last year was our best year. So we kind of feel like we're back into a growth mode. But I think, I think the challenge is always, you're always just questioning, like, I like to think of it in mathematical terms. It's like, is this a global maximum or a local maximum that we're solving? So, and I think you're always trading off, like, here's what I thought that was, but now I think that that's a local maximum, and I can see maybe the next gen of this, or how do you keep, I mean, I don't know a company that doesn't want to keep growing. So you're always just trying to figure out, how do I take where we are position wise, and now how do I imagine that being 5 or 10x where it is right today? And that a lot of times means you're evolving the problem that you think that you're solving. And that's probably why these SaaS companies are never finished. It's like, I mean, I see all these things that say some people say they're not great businesses because your highest capital outlay is your humans working on it, and they eat up and you're never done. It's not like, it's not like after I bought the tool and the die that I've got a fixed expense that now went to zero and I'm spitting out. It's like, no, this is like perpetually to stay current and to stay active. So
how do you think about funding? So you mentioned you bootstrapped it. You bootstrapped your previous business, I'm pretty sure. You raised that pre-seed round. In your mind, how should founders think about fundraising? When's the right time? Why bootstrap? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's all related to opportunity cost. So, you know, you don't have any money, but you think that there's something there. You got to go find, you got to go get the money.
Yeah.
You know, I think how much you, you know, obviously you should only raise as much as you need as you kind of go through the stages or life cycle of the company in the earliest stages, right? You should tranche that money coming in at kind of strategic times. I mean, we're all seeing today companies that raised money 2 years ago at crazy valuations are now underwater to the tune that they may not even survive, right?
Yeah.
So you got to be really careful about that. Ultimately, you're trying to time the raising of the money with the, you got to show value. You got to show that you're using that money effectively and growing. And it's, you know, the before you've got customers is a lot of people say is easier because as soon as you show dollar one, then everything's at that point doesn't matter except is your sales growing and how fast, right? Yeah. It's like, so there's a little trigger point that happens there. You know, I think the, I think for people raising money, you know, venture money is a whole different animal than angel money. You know, there's lots of ways to raise money and from different kinds of people. So I think you've got to understand how quickly what you're doing has the potential to grow. And, you know, the VC model for that is
you're putting a timestamp on your business.
You better be moving or that money's not going to care. It's going to spit you out and you're going to have a hard time raising more money or whatever, right? So I think understanding that early, and that's probably somebody that's been done this a couple of times. I've raised venture money before, so I learned the hard, you know, I learned hard knocks way of kind of what that money is and how it works. I think when you don't have those experiences, right, you just want to be around somebody who can explain it because it's like, okay, you got to understand how this works.
Yeah.
And what the expectations are on the other side. In the end, you just always want to be a good steward of the money, right? No matter whose money it is. Somebody had to make it, right? Your duty is to take it, try to use it effectively and efficiently, and hopefully you're working on something that catches fire, right?
Yeah. And, you know, when I came to work with you at Avail, you know, one of the reasons I went there was to learn from you, and because I had noticed that when we started to become friends and I saw, you know, you operate in a veil, you operate in a kind of a calm, very methodical, thoughtful manner. And sometimes founders aren't great at that. And right now is a tough time for a lot of founders, especially new founders and those founders that, you know, are maybe more aggressive than others. How do you think about, you know, managing a business and, you know, your own mental health and your own, you know, mentality, and, you know, you're very methodical and rather quiet founder. How do you think about that for yourself?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of my claims just from observing myself is that I think a lot of entrepreneurs hopefully have a sense of delayed gratification. So it's like you're in it for the chase, not the catch. So, if you've got that mindset, right, you're always giving before you get. So it's always like, I personally, I'm always feeling like I'm working on these business. I'm trying to parlay what we've got and leverage, you know, I think of it as leverage, like, hey, what do I have that I can leverage into something more? And, you know, as far as the business goes and the problems we're solving. So for me, I'm always kicking the can, like, okay, I'm just in pursuit of, I don't know where the end of it is. I just keep trying to, hey, can I take what we've got? We've gotten to here. How do I get to the next stage with as few resources as possible? And, you know, if you land on something where you know, if you need money, most of the money, I think, when you get into venture is about not building a product or finding a customer. It's about throwing gasoline on the sales fire is the best way to think about it. So until you're there and you've got that problem, you know, that's not money. That money burns really hot and really fast. So, and if you've got that problem, it's no problem finding, it's like the catch 22. It's no problem finding people that will pour, that will give you cash to pour on that fire. Everything besides that is how it's a little bit slower and a little bit more methodical, right? And your growth is going to look like up and to the right, like a line, not like a hockey stick. So we've had this nice climb since we launched the product, right? It just keeps growing, more linear than it is exponential, but it's like, okay, you can build a nice business and solve problems. And then from that standpoint, you're more conservative about how much money you want to, outside money. Like, we've gotten to the point where we're cash flowing the business. I don't have to raise any more money. So now you're in a very opportunistic raise. Like, hey, if I get to the point where I think we've got something that's going to kind of next wave catch on fire a little bit, it's like, okay, I might want to put a little bit more fuel on the fire. I've done this enough to, like, when you're looking at your checking account, it's like, you kind of know how much is coming in and how much is going out. And can you get to the point where you're like, okay, I'm kind of comfortable with where this is. What you want to not do is be like burning so fast that you've only got 2 or 3 months to live and you're not sure where that'll give you ulcers, right? Yeah. you guys have been in the situation and or seen other people in that situation. It's like, some people like that, right? They like that kind of part of the game, but I'm more of a value builder. So I'm like, build good products, understand your market, build a business out of it. The rest will kind of take care of itself, right? I'm not chasing the 30x valuation that people were trying to chase. Like, if that happens, great.
Yeah.
That's not what I get up and think about every day.
Well, on the flip side of some of the challenges and, you know, what we were just talking about there, what about some of the milestones and achievements that you're proud of with this company? I think one of them that I want to compliment you on is getting the business to a cash flow. Well, I mean, that's a huge milestone that I feel like doesn't get celebrated enough. You know, you always see like the big rounds of venture capital raise. So anyway, what are some that stand out in your mind as milestones you're proud of?
Well, for one thing, the team that built this product is still largely intact. So it was, you know, largely the engineering team. So that's been a lot of fun. Just, you know, for now, since 2015, 2016, to everybody that was working on this, you know, for the most part, still all there and intact. So I like, at least conceptually, that the reason I get up and excited, I'm still excited about what we're doing. So I like the idea that they must still be someone who's staying excited about it. So I like that we work on problems that I can get other people, you know, interested in. See, like, okay, this isn't a dead end, right? There's a lot, and we've still got a lot to do and lots of imagination about how to continue solving problems. So that's probably the biggest, you know, I think for our investors, I think, you know, we raised that round of money. I think at some point this will be a good outcome for them, right? If we can do it. And, you know, a lot of, you know, probably a big difference between angel investors, kind of level where we raised a lot of that money. It's like, they're not necessarily, they'd want to see money in their bank account, not claim that another round was raised and that the on paper value just, you know, and a lot of the venture, that's how everybody got their kicks, was like, hey, next person sold it, you know, invested at a higher valuation. So that means the imputed value of my or this much. Well, now they're all, it's like musical chairs. There's no music chairs stopped. Left. It's like, yeah, the music stopped. So, you know, so I think we're being a good steward of those investors' money, and eventually it was a good bet. And that, you know, I take pride in, hey, if you're going to invest in something I'm working on, I can't guarantee it's going to work out, but you can guarantee I'm going to work like hell to try to, you know, not only for myself, but for the employees and the investors that are involved. And, so I've felt good, you know, I feel like we've been a good steward, right, of those resources. Does that mean we make the right decisions all the time? Of course not, everybody, you know, but you correct when you find out that you maybe did something that wasn't smart, but you also measure, right? You don't just go crazy.
Yeah.
It's like very measured in kind of what we're doing and how we spend those resources. So, mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got you know, it's not only the investment money that comes in, but it's customer money. There's nothing greener than a customer's dollars buying your product, because it's like, especially in, you know, subscription model, because it's like, I mean, we sign mostly 3-year agreements. So, you know, it's not only the money that's on the books today, but I've got millions of dollars of revenue in the future that's not, doesn't even show up on the books. It's under contract.
Yep.
So this is the first time I've ever had a business that's like that. So it's like, wow, that feels good. Like, okay, there's all this money that you can kind of look out in the future. So that's, you know, unless you've run a SaaS business and gotten to the point where you've got customer revenue where that's substantial enough to be like, wow, I've never had a balance sheet with, you know, most SaaS, you don't count any more than 12 months out in the future. So if you've got 3-year contracts, you've got contract money that's not even on the books. And so that feels good. That's like a nice position to be in.
I'm sure. So we were just talking before we started recording that I think it had been like 3 years since you originally came on to talk about Avail. It was right when Evident started working for you. So let's imagine that it's another 3 years from now. We're still here doing Middle Tech, and we have you back on the Spotlight series to talk about where Avail is during that time. What would be what you would like to see at that point?
In 3 years, 5x the revenue and customer user count, which I think is doable. I think we'll over the next year develop these new features that I was kind of alluding to earlier that'll let us, we'll know pretty quickly if that's going to make the growth rate even higher. There's other potential sources of revenue. We're beginning to experiment with what it means to bring manufacturer information and data onto the platform. So it's not only what our customers are doing with it, but connecting to all these other sources of external data. So we haven't, you know, we're experimenting around with what that business model might look like and where there's potential revenue there. Again, all to solve our customer's problem. This is all related to what does it mean for them to get their job done and to do this more efficiently as we move forward. So I would claim that'd be a good 3 years if we can get there.
Awesome. Well, we'll be excited to check back in at that point. So thanks for taking the time to come in and update us and talk about Avail and everything you guys have accomplished in the past 3 years. So it's been great.
Anytime.